You're listening to an iHeart podcast.
And it's going to take us to heal us.
It's Mental Health Awareness Month, and on a recent episode of Just Heal with Dr. J, the incomparable Taraji P. Henson stopped by to discuss how she's discovered peace on her journey.
I never let that little girl inside of me die.
To hear this and more things on the journey of healing, you can listen to Just Heal with Dr. J from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
I want you to ask yourself right now, how am I actually doing? Because it's a question that we rarely ask ourselves. All of May is actually Mental Health Awareness Month, and on the Psychology of Your 20s, we are taking a vulnerable look at why mental health is so hard to talk about. Prepare for our conversations to go deep.
I spent the majority of my teenage years and my 20s just feeling absolutely terrified.
So this Mental Health Awareness Month, open the free iHeartRadio app, search the Psychology of Your 20s, and listen now.
Hi, I'm Radhi Devlukia, and I am the host of A Really Good Cry podcast. And I had the opportunity to talk to Davy Brown.
With women, any kind of thing where there might be this underlying edge of self-sacrifice as martyrdom, if you're never feeling, you're telling yourself a story and you're actually avoiding what you should be doing. You got to get in. You got to get your hands dirty.
Listen to A Really Good Cry on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Wrongful Conviction includes discussion of sexual assault and suicide. Please listen with caution and care. On November 18th, 2001, a Georgia woman found a burglar in her home who blindfolded and tied her down. He bizarrely claimed to be an Islamic militant before completing the burglary and a sexual assault. The victim described her attacker as black, and she eventually chose a man named Sterling Flint from a photo lineup. Separately, a man named Sonny Baradia reported Sterling Flint for stealing a Chevy Tahoe and a motorcycle. And while investigating that, the police found the sexual assault victim's property in Sterling's house. But Sterling's girlfriend was a former sheriff's deputy, and they both said that Sonny Baradia had asked him to hold the stolen items. Even though Sonny wasn't black, the police chose to believe that he was an Islamic militant. This is Wrongful Conviction. You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. This story today, first of all, it's going to make you want to jump through your headset, whatever you're listening to this on, and strangle somebody because, well, I've been wanting to do something like that ever since I first heard about it years ago. And I'm so glad that Sonny Baradia is here with us today to tell it. But before I introduce Sonny, I want to introduce my co-host, Ben Bolin. Many of you will know he's one of my favorite podcasters and probably one of yours as well. And we're so thrilled to have him on this season of Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you so much. This is an anger that we all share. Like you were saying, wanting to jump through the headset. We're going to talk about some gross miscarriages of justice. But I don't know, Jason, what better way to begin than to speak with the man himself?
Sonny, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And to help tell this story, we're also joined by Sonny's pro bono attorney, Olivia Vigiletti. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And this story begins in the metro Atlanta area.
Yeah, suburbs. I grew up in Stone Mountain. I mean, growing up, I had a pretty good childhood. I mean, I had parents that were married, you know, regular things like holidays, go camping, Disney World, did all that growing up. I mean, play sports, little league baseball, stuff like that, hang out with my friends and stuff. I mean, that was it.
And by the time this happened in September 2001, Sonny was in his mid-20s.
Before all this happened, I was working. I was going to school and go to the gym regularly. I was doing that sheet metal work. I mean, it's a good job because, like, at that time, probably made like $75 an hour doing it. And it gave me opportunities to move up in a job. And so for me at the time, that was good. It was something stable.
Yeah, $75 an hour was good money.
Yes.
This is how you were able to afford a Tahoe and some other nice things, right? So you were doing all right.
And you also had a side interest in
cars, vehicles.
Yeah.
Yes. My little side thing was I like to buy cars and fix them and sell them.
And Sonny was very generous with his talents, especially with his close friends, Rayshawn and Keisha Pitts. While it seems some acquaintances took advantage of Sonny's generosity, one of whom was a guy named Sterling Flint. But before Sterling enters the story, a different friend who stayed in Beaufort, South Carolina, had asked to borrow Sonny's Chevy Tahoe.
I let a friend of mine use my car because his car was in the shop. I'm like, sure, just for like 2-3 days he can. And it ended up being a breach of trust. Like when Friday came, it's like his cell phone was cut off, so he wouldn't respond. And I knew he was at his mother's house in South Carolina. So I got a hold of his ex-wife, got his mother's address, and I called DeKalb County Police, explained what happened to my vehicle. And I remember clearly being a Saturday, November 17th, 2001. I met a friend of mine named Rayshawn's house. He's actually from Brooklyn. And so I used to go check on his wife when he's out of town in New York working and take his wife's kids out.
That night, Sonny, his girlfriend, Alicia Colbert, and Rayshawn's wife, Keisha, they all went out together with their kids for the opening weekend of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which they watched at a drive-in. Now, they got home very late, around midnight.
So the next day being Sunday, which was the day of the crime, November 18th, 2001, I'm at my girlfriend's house. About 10 o'clock, my cell phone rings, and it's a detective from Beaufort County, South Carolina, and he told me he has my vehicle in his impound, and I can pick it up Monday through Friday. So that day, I dropped my girlfriend's daughter to her mother's house. I took my girlfriend, took her to Wendy's. I went through the drive-thru, they got cameras. I got her something to eat. And I dropped across the street to a job. And then I called my friend Rayshawn, and I asked him if I'd pick up a socket set from his house because I was working on this car I bought from an auction a while back. So I get the socket set a little after like 12 o'clock. And I go to a friend of mine's house. I had a car parked there, which I was working on. And around 4:30, 5 o'clock, I stopped by Rayshawn's, dropped the socket set off.
So Sonny's whereabouts were accounted for in the metro Atlanta area, over 250 miles away from the scene of the crime, which was in a Savannah suburb called Thunderbolt, Georgia. Now, remember, this happened not even 10 weeks after 9/11, when average Americans were just learning the names of militant groups like Al-Qaeda, and this fear of terrorist cells operating in the U.S. was at a fever pitch. So with that backdrop, it's believed that an acquaintance of Sonny's named Sterling Flint committed a burglary in the early afternoon of November 18th, 2001.
Basically, this was a daytime burglary gone wrong. Sterling Flint breaks into the house and he's stealing electronics and the victim comes home. So he very quickly blindfolds her and he tells her this very scary story about how he's part of Al-Qaeda and he was sent here for her. And she says in her original police statement that he was pretending to be on the phone with someone else who's maybe like instructing him what to do next. But she knew that there was no one actually on the phone. She could hear the dial tone. And he tells her he needs to commit what he calls a fake rape to make this other person happy so that she's scared quiet. And he's holding her at knife point and does some assaultive things to her.
Be aware, the following language is graphic and may be disturbing. This is from the victim's statement. The victim says this man tied her up to the bed, performed oral sex on her, masturbated, ejaculated, cleaned up after himself, and then left with a number of electronic items and a suitcase. When the victim freed herself and removed the blindfold, she noticed it was 2:40 p.m.
Fortunately for Sonny, before she gets blindfolded, she sees he's wearing blue and white batting gloves, and she tells the police that. But the GBI, the Georgia labs at the time, were only testing fluids. The labs weren't doing touch DNA testing. So they scan all the evidence that they have. They don't find any fluids. They say there's nothing to test. And that's really important.
We're going to hold on to that detail for later. But at that time, all they had to go on was her description. Now, remember, the attacker was partially masked. She had only seen his eyes shortly before she was blindfolded, and the victim was white, which made this a cross-racial identification situation, whether with the actual attacker as described by the victim or with Sonny.
The victim's description of the guy was a black male, bushy eyebrows, bushy mustache, dark skin, rough skin, face, 5'6", 150. I was like 185. I used to go to the gym like 4 days a week at a time. So you would not say I'm 150 pounds. You would not say I was a black male.
After all, Sonny's ethnicity is Indian, which I guess if you're a racist and you're also not good at being racist, then that makes Sonny a member of Al-Qaeda somehow. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. At this point, they had made a composite sketch of a black man. Meanwhile, Sonny was headed just a short distance north of Savannah, Georgia, to Beaufort County, South Carolina, to get his car back. However, the only friend he could scramble to come with him to drive one of the vehicles back home, she had a problem with her license.
We finally get to Beaufort like 5 p.m. on November 19th, and I pick my vehicle up, and just randomly Sterling Flint called me at that time. And I've only seen this guy once or twice, so he's like, where am I at? I said, I'm in Beaufort, and he's like, well, you're like 30 minutes from me. It's like light bulb goes off in the head. And I was like, hey, man, is there any way you're in Atlanta soon? Because I got this girl with me, took me to get my car, but she has some type of issue with license. I think she had a DUI or something. So I didn't want to get him pulled over going back to Atlanta driving behind me, you know? So I asked him to drive my vehicle back, and he's like, sure. So we end up in Savannah, and we met him and his girlfriend at a restaurant. We ate dinner, and he left on his motorcycle, and I follow his girlfriend to his house. So we get to his house. She introduced me to her roommate. He was a Chatham County Sheriff's Deputy, and she tells me she used to be a Chatham County Sheriff's Deputy.
Now, it appears that Sterling's girlfriend, Ashley Dold's affiliation to law enforcement may have played a role in this case. But at this point in the story, Sterling Flint parked his motorcycle at home. He got in the Chevy Tahoe and was supposed to follow Sonny back to his friend's house in Atlanta.
When we entered one of the interstates in Atlanta, my vehicle disappeared. I don't see him on the highway no more. Finally, when I get to my friend's house, I keep calling his phone. He's not answering. Probably about 3 o'clock in the morning he calls. And he says that he stopped for gas. And he ran into a friend of his, ain't seen in some years, and he'll be it in a few. So she left the door unlocked. So I wake up probably about 7 o'clock, and it's like, you know, you have that feeling like your whole stomach's just churning, like you just know something's not right. And so about 11 o'clock in the morning, he calls, and he says he stopped at his mom's house. And I remember I clearly looked at the phone number and the call ID. I wrote the number down, and he'll be it in a few. Well, I'm waiting. He never comes. So going into the next morning, I called his mother's house, and I'm like asking if he's there. And she's like, no. And I said, well, my name's Sonny. I said, your son has my vehicle. Can you ask him to bring it back by 12 o'clock noon? If he doesn't, I'm reported stolen. So right before noon, I hear my friend on the phone arguing with somebody and yelling and stuff. So I asked her what's going on. She's like, that's Sterling. And she's saying he's threatening to kill her. So I grab the phone. He said he's going to kill my family because he's got my home address because I've got mail in my car. And he's going to kill my girlfriend and kill me. So I call the police.
Sonny made a police report that Sterling Flint had stolen his Chevy Tahoe and made terroristic threats. Now, at some point, the burglary and sexual assault victim viewed a photo lineup and identified Sterling Flint as her attacker. So now, Sterling is wanted by Thunderbolt PD in Chatham County for terroristic threats in DeKalb County, as well as in Clayton County, where he first made off with the Chevy Tahoe.
So this whole time I'm calling Sterling, finally he answers. He says he's going to run my truck off a cliff, going to kill my family. And I said, man, I work for everything I have. And you got a motorcycle. It's like, F that bike, it's hot. And he mentions it's stolen. And a couple of days later, November 27th, 28th, there was a message my parents' voicemail for me to call. It's Detective Underwood in Cobb County. And he asked if I know Sterling Flint. And I'm like, yes, that's the guy who stole my vehicle. And he's like, the reason I came looking for you, your vehicle's involved in a burglary in Cobb County. And the residents came home and Sterling Flint was in their house. And he assaulted a guy, fled in a Tahoe, which was my vehicle. So to report a tag number. When he ran the tag, it showed up in my name, but it also showed up it was stolen a week prior. He goes, well, your vehicle was in a high-speed chase with Atlanta PD last night. And a black male jumped out of a vehicle, fled on foot, and my vehicle went down a hill, hit a telephone pole. So he's like, they're looking for him now. So he asked for me to get in touch with him, and I'm like, well, this is his girlfriend's phone number, if that'll help.
So Detective Underwood called Chatham County, shared Ashley Dold's phone number, but they already knew her, and they went looking for the stolen motorcycle.
When the police show up to Sterling Flint's house, the victim's stolen items are inside of his house. And we know that they're her items because he stole some luggage and it had her name on it. So we know they're her items. And the batting gloves she describes to the police are with the stolen items.
When they found his stuff at her house, she called him on the phone, I guess not knowing stuff is stolen. And he tells her, say, I brought the stuff there.
Sterling Flint says, I am holding these items for Sonny Baradia.
Now, understand his girlfriend was an ex-Chatham County Sheriff's Deputy. Roommates of Chatham County Sheriff's Deputy telling a Thunderbolt police officer, which is in Chatham County, that I brought this stuff there. Now the whole storyline changes from a blackmail to me.
it's kind of brilliant, right? Because he's like, hey, let me get out of this crap that I did and let me implicate this guy that's giving me trouble for stealing his car. The police should have said, well, that's absurd. That doesn't make sense. Sonny is the one who sent us over here. Why would Sonny tell the police, hey, go check out this guy when he's holding stolen items for Sonny? It doesn't make any sense.
Plus, the victim had already identified Sterling Flint from a photo array. So this case literally came with instructions.
But when we're thinking about how to secure a conviction, they only had the victims who was blindfolded for most of it. They only had her identification. Well, if Sterling Flint is willing to testify against Sonny, then now they have two witnesses that would speak against Sonny, where there's only maybe one witness that would speak against Sterling Flint.
But then the lead detective on the burglary and sexual assault in Thunderbolt, Detective Henry Trey Connors, brought the victim in to view a second photo lineup. This time, Sterling Flint wasn't even in it.
Every photo on the lineup was blurred, and there were black males. One guy had one eye, and I was the only clear photo on the lineup. She has circled photo number 4, which was me, photo number 6, somebody else. In another lineup, she circled Sterling Flint. So she identified 3 different people, but one person did the crime.
Which is a traumatized person who didn't get a good look at the perpetrator. We're talking about cross-racial identification. Mm. There's a lot of research that shows that all humans of all races are worse at identifying strangers of other races than they are strangers of their own race.
I'll take it one step further, Olivia, which is that multiple studies have shown that particularly in instances where someone has either been a victim or a witness to a violent crime, cross-racial identification has been proven to be less accurate than guessing, which means, as crazy as it sounds, a person who wasn't even there, just by virtue of guessing, would have a better chance of identifying the actual perpetrator than somebody who was.
Yeah, it's understandable that she made that mistake. It's not understandable that the police rolled with it.
So the next day, which was Friday, November 30th, I got arrested. They served me a warrant for burglary, sexual assault, aggravated sodomy, and kidnapping. I'm laughing, thinking it's candid camera, like this some kind of sordid joke, you know? But when they pulled the guns out, I knew this was serious. And the detective goes, you know why I arrested you? And I'm like, why? He goes, Ashley Dole, which is Sterling Flint's girlfriend, the ex-sheriff's deputy, I arrested you because of what she said, not because of what the victim said. I didn't know what to think.
The American West with Dan Flores is the latest show from the Meat Eater Podcast Network, hosted by me, writer and historian Dan Flores, and brought to you by Velvet Buck. This podcast looks at a West available nowhere else. Each episode, I'll be diving into some of the lesser-known histories of the West. I'll then be joined in conversation by guests such as Western historian Dr. Randall Williams and best-selling author and Meat Eater founder Stephen Ranella.
I'll correct my kids now and then where they'll say when cave people were here. And I'll say, it seems like the Ice Age people that were here didn't have a real affinity for caves.
So join me starting Tuesday, May 6th, where we'll delve into stories of the West and come to understand how it helps inform the ways in which we experience the region today.
Listen to The American West with Dan Flores on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On November 5th, 2018, at 6:33 a.m., a red Volkswagen Golf was found abandoned in a ditch out in Sleep Hole Valley. The driver's seat door was open. No traces of footsteps leaving the vehicle. No belongings were found, except for a cassette tape lodged in the player. On that tape were 10 vile, grotesque,
oh my God,
horrific stories that to this day have been kept restricted from the public. Until now. You feeling this too? A horror anthology podcast. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1978, Roger Caron's first book was published, and he was unlike any first-time author Canada had ever seen.
Roger Caron was 16 when first convicted.
Has spent 24 of those years in jail.
12 years in solitary.
He went from an ex-con to a literary darling almost overnight.
He was instantly a celebrity.
He was an adrenaline junkie, and he was the star of the show.
Go Boy is the gritty true story of how one man fought his way out of some of the darkest places imaginable.
I had a knife go in my stomach, puncture my spleen, break my ribs. I had my guts all in my hands.
Only to find himself back where he started.
Roger's saying is, I've never hurt anybody but myself. And I said, oh, you're so wrong. You're so wrong on that one, Rob.
From Campside Media and iHeart Podcasts, listen to Go Boy on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
They placed me under arrest. It said a crime happened in Thunderbolt. I've never heard this town in my life. I can never forget this. I had these boots on. One of the officers like, it's going to be a long time before he sees them boots again. I never forget that.
Sonny couldn't bond out and spent about a year and a half in pretrial detention, while Sterling Flint, the man whose whereabouts were unknown during the crime, the man who was fending off several other burglary charges, as well as a charge for Sonny's stolen vehicle and a motorcycle. The guy who was originally identified by the victim and had her belongings, he was able to shift the blame onto Sonny, and he appeared to have everyone's help in doing so.
Sterling Flint took a plea to receiving stolen property, right? Because that's his story, that he received these things from Sonny. As far as I know, that's the deal. He got to testify against Sonny. Of course, there's these other separate crimes in a separate county, and so he was working on that. He is actually, if you can believe it, a jailhouse informant in another Georgia Innocence Project case where he cut a deal to completely fabricate a story against another man. And so this is kind of his MO. It's, what will you give me? And I'll say whatever.
And that man's name is Eric Hurd. Now, over 20% of the first 250 DNA exonerations in history involved the use of jailhouse informants, which isn't hard to believe considering how much these jailhouse snitches or informants have to gain from their incentivized testimony. But it appears that the lead detective had a motivation to ignore this more compelling suspect, instead choosing to pursue what was an impossible narrative.
We go to my preliminary hearing, and the detective, his whole events were when I came to Savannah and picked my vehicle up from the impound, he said I did all that Sunday. Records show my vehicle was an impound Sunday. I didn't even have my vehicle that Sunday. I came to Savannah that Monday, and then we did a video audio statement in front of an attorney, and he's saying my account for that day. And I'm like, look, these are my witnesses. I said I went through Wendy's that morning to have cameras. I went through this Quick Trip gas station to have cameras. This can all be substantiated. These are my witnesses. He didn't care about none of that. In his mind, I'm a Muslim. I come did this, and he goes that he called home security, said this guy's a terrorist. You need to check on him. This is literally what the guy said.
So it seems that this detective, Henry Trey Connors, well, he thought that Sonny's complexion made him a better fit for Al-Qaeda than Sterling Flint. This still wouldn't have been acceptable if Sonny was Muslim or Arab, but to make matters even more absurd, Sonny is an Indian-American evangelical Christian, not a black man, as the victim had described to this detective.
Yeah, the lead detective got arrested before my trial on something else he had going on. The photo lineups disappeared. The original police statement disappeared, which before my name was put into it. The victim description of the guy was a black male, bushy eyebrows, bushy mustache, dark skin, rough skin, face, 5'6", 150.
So Sonny's trial attorney believed that he'd be able to use that evidence at trial in June 2003, since after all, this was an accurate description of Sterling Flint.
Yes, it was him. It's his description to the T. And she has circled him on one of the photo lineups.
Trial counsel's whole strategy was to show the two photo arrays where the victim identifies Sterling Flint, and she does a second photo array where Sterling Flint is not a part of it, and she identifies one other black man in Sonny. That's his whole strategy. He's going to show how ridiculously dissimilar these people look and that she identified everyone, and it destroys the case, and that's his whole plan. Well, he doesn't get the photo arrays before trial. He expects the prosecution to show up with the photo arrays at trial, and they don't.
He's seen them, but the DA doesn't have a copy of them. When I was testifying, the trial attorney, he stated, like on his little ad lib, started talking about the lineups, how I was only clear photo, that every photo on the lineup was blurred and they were black males. He said he talked to the chief police at that time, and he goes, chief police said that he laughed about it. He's like, this case is nonsensical. Just the things didn't add up.
Trial counsel's whole strategy is gone. So he, with no preparation, calls alibi witnesses to the stand who were just thinking they're going to court to sit in the gallery and support Sonny. So he's calling Sonny's girlfriend, Sonny's friend to the stand, and they're trying to remember dates and things off the top of their heads. They're not prepared.
If you remember, Sonny and his alibi witnesses had seen Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone on November 17th, the second day of its release in the U.S.
They get the date wrong of when they go to the movies. Sonny's girlfriend says, we took the kids to see the Harry Potter movie on this date. It wasn't this other date. Well, the movie wasn't even out yet.
Misremembering this event as from a prior weekend appears to have damaged the rest of Sonny's alibi, as far as when he picked up and dropped off the socket wrenches with Keisha Pitts.
So we know it's just a mix-up. It's because they weren't prepared because he wasn't prepared. And I think that this case is so ridiculous, he kind of thought it would resolve itself. But that's not an attorney strategy. You have to be over-prepared. He didn't investigate the alibi any more than the police did.
Sonny's cell phone records would have placed him in Atlanta. The Wendy's security cam at 11 a.m. would have left Sonny with insufficient time to make the four-hour one-way trip to Thunderbolt in order to commit the crime before 2:40 p.m. And it would have been helpful if the batting gloves had been tested for touch DNA. But at that time, testing of this nature wasn't even being done by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. And then Sterling Flint took the stand.
So Sterling Flint, at this time, had been convicted of committing two other burglaries in Sonny's Tahoe. Daytime burglaries, very similar crimes. He does not come prepared with the police reports. And he thinks at the time that they're open charges against Sterling Flint. He doesn't realize he took a plea. He's already been convicted of those. So he asked Sterling Flint on the stand, well, isn't it true that you have these pending charges of burglaries? And Sterling Flint says, no, that's not true. They've been disposed of. Well, that's a tricky way to say it, but yeah, he is right. It's not true that he had pending charges. He had convictions for similar crimes. And the attorney didn't come in prepared to say, look, this guy was stealing things out of people's homes in Sonny's Tahoe.
And without all of this crucial preparation, Sonny didn't have a chance in hell when the victim took the stand.
I was sure this girl would see me and say I'm not the guy because I didn't see it till I went to court. And when she got on oath, she goes, her friend emailed her article about a crime when I got arrested. Yeah, a color photo of me in the paper. She testified that she's been looking at that photo every day. She goes, those were the eyes. I got brown eyes. He has brown eyes. I just couldn't believe it. Like, my heart dropped because I was adamant, like, she's going to see me say, hey, this ain't the guy.
And the district attorney leaned into the racism of the time to further seal Sonny's fate.
I remember clearly being at trial. The DH, she goes, am I a Muslim? And I said, no. I said, I used to go to this church here. If you choose to be a Muslim, that's fine. I respect that. By faith, I'm Christian. And she's like, no, you're a Muslim. And I'm like, I'm not a Muslim. And it's on my trial transcript. She's telling me I'm a Muslim. And you know how the jury looked at the post-9/11? I get convicted, and the judge said life without parole. That's the first in my life my knees ever shook.
The American West with Dan Flores is the latest show from the Meat Eater Podcast Network, hosted by me, writer and historian Dan Flores, and brought to you by Velvet Buck. This podcast looks at a West available nowhere else. Each episode, I'll be diving into some of the lesser-known histories of the West. I'll then be joined in conversation by guests such as Western historian Dr. Randall Williams and best-selling author and Meat Eater founder Stephen Ranella.
I'll correct my kids now and then where they'll say when cave people were here. And I'll say, it seems like the Ice Age people that were here didn't have a real affinity for caves.
So join me starting Tuesday, May 6th, where we'll delve into stories of the West and come to understand how it helps inform the ways in which we experience the region today.
Listen to The American West with Dan Flores on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On November 5th, 2018, at 6:33 a.m., a red Volkswagen Golf was found abandoned in a ditch out in Sleep Hole Valley. The driver's seat door was open. No traces of footsteps leaving the vehicle. No belongings were found, except for a cassette tape lodged in the player. On that tape were 10 vile...
No!
Ah! grotesque.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Horrific stories that to this day have been kept restricted from the public. Until now. You feeling this too? A horror anthology podcast. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Michael Kasson, founder and CEO of 3C Ventures and your guide on Good Company, the podcast where I sit down with the boldest innovators shaping what's next. In this episode, I'm joined by Anjali Sood, CEO of Tubi, for a conversation that's anything but ordinary. We dive into the competitive world of streaming, how she's turning so-called niche into mainstream gold, connecting audiences with stories that truly make them feel seen.
What others dismiss as niche, we embrace as core. It's this idea that there's so many stories out there, and if you can find a way to curate and help the right person discover the right content, the term that we always hear from our audience is that they feel seen.
Get a front row seat to where media, marketing, technology, entertainment, and sports collide, and hear how leaders like Anjali are carving out space and shaking things up a bit in the most crowded of markets. Listen to Good Company on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like you're trying to process this, like, this is a nightmare that just won't stop. Here I'm in prison for something I did not do, and they want me to die. How are you supposed to process that? You know, prisons are violent. I mean, it's like a fight or flight mode. You're in the jungle and you have to survive. And you are, it's like you're a sheep you put in a jungle full of lions. I mean, what are you supposed to do? I was at Hays State Prison, like, 2005 through 14. The captain of the prison was putting hits on inmates and officers. So you understand, like, this is general knowledge. Everybody knew this. Like, he'd bring, like, the contraband in, give it to this gang. This gang would take him off. He'd go have this officer go confiscate it, give it to another gang. And, like, it was so wild. And my officers were saying they were scared to come into dormitories because inmates ran to prison. They would literally, they might kidnap somebody from one building, have them in another building, calling their family, threatening to kill them if they don't send them money. So this is the environment you're in. And you got to survive. It's not only inmates. You have to look at officers, too. And like 2018, I went in a dormitory. Officer opened the doors, two officers right there. And a guy comes in with a knife about a foot long. The officer's just looking at him. They got tasers on them. They're just looking like with a mouse ajar. I'm like 40-something years old. This guy's like half my age. I can't run it. So I'm trying to fight this guy. And finally, by fluke, I pushed him and he fell. And I got on top of him. And then the officers came, threw me against the wall, handcuffed me. And that's when I saw blood all over me. I got stabbed 12 times.
Jesus.
I didn't even know I'd got stabbed, but this is Georgia prisons. Like, a life is not valued. And I'm okay. I made it through that. It was a nightmare. Through it all, I lost my father. I lost people dear to me. And you see yours, your life go by. You see your youth go by, the prom your life go by.
Winning his freedom was an urgent matter that took just short of 23 long years.
In Georgia, the first step after your conviction is called a motion for a new trial. And so it's basically an appeal that goes back to that same court, that same judge. So that was filed right after Sonny's conviction. And it was amended by Sonny's appellate attorney to add just a mountain of claims. I mean, Sonny's appellate attorney always believed in his innocence, and he raised buckets of claims for him.
And many of these claims stem from the ineffectiveness of his trial counsel. This is when the batting gloves come into play. Let's remember, Georgia Bureau of Investigation only DNA tested biological fluids. These gloves needed touch DNA testing, meaning they needed to lift skin cells from inside the gloves. And Sonny's appellate attorney got this testing approved.
In 2004, my attorney wrote me a letter. And he goes, hey, are you sure you want to get DNA tested on these gloves? Because if it comes back showing it's you, that's the final nail in the coffin. And I wrote him a letter in big words, I am innocent. And I mailed it to him.
And so when Sonny's appellate attorney gets this super cutting edge test done, he has to send it to a lab in California because he can't find anyone locally that's doing it. Sonny's appellate attorney believes in him so wholeheartedly, he offers to forego his own pay in the case to pay for the DNA testing. And the court takes him up on it. He gets the DNA results. They exclude Sonny.
But also on the outside of gloves, because the victim goes, I covered a mouth with gloves. He said there's female DNA outside of gloves. They got a Coke can from the victim's house. He tested, and the same female DNA in Coke can is on the outside of gloves. That's the victim, pretty much. So he recommends that for a profile of the victim's DNA get taken, as well as Sterling Flint's. The state objects to it.
So he moves forward with the only new evidence that he's got.
However, the way he raised the new evidence was that the trial attorney should have gotten this test done. Well, that's not really true. The trial attorney can't be expected to get a test done that the Georgia lab won't even do. He does at the end throw in like, or maybe this is new evidence, but when you raise a new evidence claim, you have to make a really specific showing, and he doesn't make that showing. And he gets a hearing on this motion for new trial, so he gets to put some evidence on the record. And so even though this evidence that Sonny was not part of this crime, this DNA evidence has existed since like 2003, the way that it was raised procedurally posed a problem. It's not the right claim because he actually went so far above and beyond what an attorney can be expected to do to get this test done. So we can't say the trial counsel was deficient for not doing the same thing.
The courts concluded that the attorney was not at fault. So even though the new evidence proved Sonny's innocence, this claim failed.
The next thing that happens is the appellate attorney starts partnering with the Georgia Innocence Project around 2011 to file what in Georgia is called an extraordinary motion for new trial, a post-conviction litigation avenue in the state of Georgia where you have new evidence that was not available to you before. And one of the bases for this new evidence is that in 2012, they were able to get a CODIS hit for Sterling Flint on the gloves. And so that gets litigated all the way up, Sonny's appellate attorney and GIP working together. But because there had already been this incorrect belief out in the world of this case, it had been talked about in briefs and opinions that maybe trial counsel should have done this. And then there wasn't really ever clarification of, no, actually trial counsel couldn't have reasonably done this. He loses all the way up, and that goes up to the Supreme Court of Georgia, and they say trial counsel should have gotten this test done. If you got it done a year later, trial counsel should have done it without really appreciating what he went through to get the test done.
The crazy thing is the GBI testified that they didn't start that test in 2011, and you had to go through all kinds of red tape to get that test done. It was in 2015 that you could readily access and do that test in Georgia. So you're holding me accountable in 2003 for a test that the crime lab didn't even use in 2011.
It also kind of sounds like they reversed course on the earlier ruling that trial counsel was not ineffective. Now they're saying that trial counsel could have done this, but it doesn't matter since it's procedurally barred. So after this defeat, Sonny's attorneys needed to regroup. And in the interim, Ashley Dold did an interview.
She did an interview called Shadow of Doubt with 11 of Life's on YouTube. And originally the stolen goods, she goes that when her boyfriend picked up from work, he had a U-Haul trailer and he had a burglary in Cobb County involving a U-Haul trailer. And they parked the U-Haul trailer at her sister's house, and her sister stayed a stone's throw from the victim's house. She calls a couple of days later, says, hey, can you go to your sister's house, go get the stuff out of U-Haul and put it at your house? And that's the victim's stolen goods. She covered up for her boyfriend, and she went on TV years ago, said when they found the stuff, he told her, hey, I brought the stuff there. So she believed in what he said, told the police that. Then the whole storyline changes. So there's one police officer telling another police officer, hey, whose word are they going to take?
Just one officer to another. And she said the stolen goods came from Sonny. And then the victim viewed another photo lineup. This one did not contain Sterling Flint and only had one clear photo, Sonny's. But it doesn't even have to be that devious for cross-racial misidentification to occur. Consider the case of Ronald Cotton and Jennifer Thompson.
I came across a book years ago, Picking Cotton, 2016, and it was about a guy named Ronald Cotton, said he was convicted of a crime he was innocent of. So it touched me because victim Jennifer Thompson said this was the guy. She was sure that it was him, the eyes and this and that. I can empathize with that because in my case, that's exactly what happened.
We covered the case on the podcast, and Jennifer Thompson was called the perfect witness. She was home. She was sober. She was awake. And a black man broke into her home and tied her up and brutally assaulted her for 25 minutes. And her whole being was wrapped up, as she describes it, in studying every feature. Because as she says, I get the chills thinking about it, if I survived, I was going to make sure that I could identify this man so no one would ever have to suffer the way I was, and I would be able to put him away. And sure enough, they picked up somebody not too long after this horrible crime occurred, and she identified him in a photo array, in a lineup, and a trial. with absolute certainty. And of course, he was convicted and sentenced to, I don't remember if it was life, but a long time in prison. And 11 years later, there was another guy in the prison that people were talking about. He's the one who actually committed the crime. It turned out he looked very much like Mr. Cotton. And DNA ultimately proved that he, in fact, was the perpetrator. And he had gone on to commit many other horrible crimes by the time he was arrested.
And just a small plug to defense attorneys and prosecutors, she founded an organization called Healing Justice. And if you're in a situation like this where you need to approach a victim and you're trying not to do more harm, you're trying not to impose more trauma, her organization will help you figure out how to do that the best way. So I've used that many times, and it's so important because this problem is not an individual's problem. It's a systemic problem.
It's a great organization, and I'm a proud donor. And Jennifer is one of my heroes, as is Ronald Cotton. And important to note, they became very close friends. They wrote Picking Cotton, which is such an incredible name. They've done 60 Minutes together. They've been on Wrongful Conviction together. They've toured the country giving presentations to law students and prosecutors and anyone that will listen to them about the unreliability of eyewitness identification. And Sunny, if memory serves me, she brought your case to my attention and our attention.
Yes. So I got in touch with her on Facebook, and she's like, I'm on Team Sunny. So she was in my life regularly for me. She's one of my mentors. She really is. I tried to hang myself years ago. I actually did. I didn't succeed. I got stabbed like 12 times. Just went through some things. But it's like Jennifer was like one of the people I'd always go to kind of give me a reality check. She was always blunt with me and honest with me. She's like, I'm going to beat it at the gates when you get out. And it's like these things manifested. They really did. And she kept a word.
She's kind of like an angel. She has a very angelic quality about her. So Jennifer, if you're listening and you're blushing, you should be, because we have so much respect for you here. So, okay. So then along comes your other angel, Olivia, right?
I was working for the Georgia Innocence Project. Sunny was my first client. So even after I left the Georgia Innocence Project, it's always hard to leave a job, leave your cases, but I couldn't leave Sunny. So I have stayed with him as pro bono counsel for the past 3 years. And so when we filed an amended habeas petition in 2022, all of our claims, they were all based on ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for the way he raised the claims. And I want to just be really clear, ineffective assistance of counsel doesn't mean bad attorney. This appellate counsel did an amazing job getting the DNA, very vigorous advocate, and still it was constitutionally defective. So we were granted an evidentiary hearing in the middle of 2023, where we put all this evidence on the record that finally clarified what these procedural mistakes were. And Sunny's appellate attorney was very helpful at the hearing. He explained that he just made a lot of mistakes.
In addition, many witnesses testified in support of Sonny's innocence claim, including Ashley Dold.
She testified that I wasn't there. They wasn't asked enough by Sterling Flint, but she pretty much testified that she wasn't there. And my ex-girlfriend testified, the one who got confused at trial, and one of my witnesses died over the years.
And that was Keisha Pitts. But her husband, Ray Sean, took the stand in her stead.
He said he remembers I called him that morning and asked if I'd pick a socket set from his house. And Keisha called him, and he's like, Sunny came, picked it up. And then when I came back that evening, probably around 5 o'clock, he said that she called him to Sunny, dropped the stuff off.
And this established a time frame which made it impossible for an 8-hour round trip to Thunderbolt, Georgia, a time frame that your trial counsel didn't prepare enough to even do a rudimentary job of laying it out.
And I will say that trial attorney did testify, and he wept on the stand. He told us he thinks about Sunny all the time. This case keeps him up at night. He always believed in Sunny. He just was so overconfident because the case was so ridiculous and had a lot of regret. But of course, we can't not prepare just because a case is ridiculous. And in 2024, Judge Tate out of Gwinnett County granted Sonny's habeas petition, which was not appealed by the attorney general. So that overturned his conviction.
Sonny was transferred to a jail prior to his release, but the date of his actual release still remained unclear.
Sunny and I that morning had such an emo conversation because there was like some paperwork stuff. And I was like, look, the paperwork's not done. I don't know when you're getting out. You're not going to be getting out. We were both like, oh, sad. We didn't think he was getting out that day.
I was in a county jail, but I remember I go up to intake and she told the officer, like, get my property and stuff. So I had certain books like Long Walk to Freedom, my Bible, some letters I kept over the years. And these things meant something to me. So they're like in a little clear trash bag. So she tells us to dress me out. So I'm still like, the reality is not setting in. Like, something's going to happen. Like, they're going to say, hey, we're making a mistake or something. So finally I said, hey, can I put my shoes on? And when she said, yeah, and I'm like, hey, about let me out. And then she told me, like, hey, you got to go out this door. So when I go out the door, it's the officer in the Sally Port with some inmates escorting him in the vehicle. He's like, unless you're going with us, press that button. When I press the button, the door opens. It's a parking lot. So it's me, this trash bag of books, and a parking lot. This is day 8,393 for me, you know?
Wow.
So I run. I Forrest Gumped it at that guy. Forrest Gump was running at the running down his driveway. Yeah. That's how I was running. I didn't know where I was going. I was just running. I said, I got to get on the phone somehow to call Olivia. I don't know how I'm gonna, what I'm going to do, but I got to get on the phone to call Olivia. So I ran one way, and it's like a concrete plant. So I'm like, well, this is the wrong way. So then I'm running along a tree line because so I'm like looking back saying, hey, they might realize we made a mistake, let this guy out. So I keep looking back every second paranoid. My bag of books is like coming apart, like holes in it. And I'm trying to hold these books together. So I'm thinking, like, well, hey, I might just hide these in a ditch or something, drainage ditch, like come back later, get them. I just got to get to a phone. And finally, I get to this little place. And I'm like yelling, can somebody help me? Can somebody help me? And the guy's like, how can I help you? I said, hey, my name's Sonny Baratta. You can Google me. They just let me out of jail. I was innocent. I've been in prison 20-something years. I just need to call my attorney so to come get me. And I remember he called. He's like, what's the phone number? He started laughing. He called. It was Livia.
And then I get this random number call, and I know it's Sonny. And I pick up the phone, and he said, they let me out. They let me out. They let me out. I don't know where I am. And then a man who I guess owned this shop gets on the phone, gives me the address, and hangs up on me. And that's it. That's all the information I get. And so I pass the information along to someone closer, and she said, why is he at this address? And I was like, I don't know. I literally had a 10-second conversation about it.
And by the time I got home, Olivia was at my mother's house, came from Detroit, and Jennifer Thompson came from Chapel Hill. She was at my mom's house.
Amazing.
So it was like such a highlight. It was like a mountain. Yeah. It was like a mountaintop experience. The last couple months, I mean, just trying to find my place right now. I have PTSD, yes. I mean, true, I do. But, you know, I'm getting help for it, and I'm working on it. I try to keep routine. Go to gym about 4 or 5 days a week. I have been writing a book, and it's still hard to process it all to this day. I mean, it's like I just really don't even try to think on it. I don't understand the purpose why I went through it, but it's like at the same time, I like to help people. Me and Jennifer Thompson talked about it, and she was like, maybe I could start some time healing justice thing in Georgia. So that's maybe one thing I'm looking at. But I know the importance of not having a voice because so many years I didn't have a voice. And I have a voice now, so I want to use my voice to help people that don't have a voice. And I feel somewhere along the way I'll be able to do that.
If anyone would like to talk to Sonny about public speaking, and I really hope you will, then we're going to link his Instagram in the episode description so you can reach out on DM. We're also going to link to Healing Justice and the episode that Jennifer Thompson and Ronald Cotton did together.
And since the recording of this interview on May 16th, 2025, Sonny's charges were officially dismissed.
The feeling itself was exhilarating. I mean, I've never had a feeling like that. It's like a weight off you. And Jennifer Thompson of Healing Justice was there. My attorney, Olivia Vigiletti, Christina Cribbs, Noah Pines, and the Georgia Innocence Project, and my mom. And it was just amazing because I couldn't have made it in this journey without these people. After my dismissal, they held like a little potluck type party and we went to downtown Atlantis, the rooftop bar. And then Saturday, me, Jennifer, and Livy went hiking. And then Sunday, the Innocence Project had a picnic. And then me and my girlfriend drove down to Florida. So I've been in Panama City Beach since Sunday. I stayed here for a week. And needed this. Much needed.
We were all so happy for you, while, of course, wishing that this never happened in the first place.
And with that, we're going to go to closing arguments, where first we thank both of you for joining us. And then I'm just going to turn my microphone off with my headphones on and just kick back in my chair and listen for you to share anything you feel is left to be said. We're going to start with Olivia and then Sonny, you take us off into the sunset.
Wow, that is fun. And I feel very put on the spot. I would like to tell a story of Sonny because it's, of course, never a requirement that your client be exceptional and incredible. But Sonny has been lead counsel on this case his entire life and the whole time he's been fighting this and has taught me a lot of things at every turn. And we were talking one time, kind of dreaming about the day Sonny might get out of prison. And I asked him how he was preparing to transition back into the world. And he told me something that I thought was really random at first, but connected it back. He said, do you remember in the 90s when they would always show the oil spills on TV and you'd always see like oil covered pictures of ducks and stuff, but then they show that like you just wipe them down with some Dawn and then they're okay after you clean them up. But if the oil gets into the animal's body, things get really bad and you die instantly. And he was like, that's been my task here in prison the entire time. I'm in this environment, but it is not inside of me. And so from here until I'm out, I just have to keep myself fortified and know that although it is all around me, I can clean this off and it's going to be okay. It's not inside of me, so I'm not going to die.
All I can say is that I'm grateful and humbled, because when you're in prison, life out parole, and it's like you're fighting with hope, and it's hard. And you see people with serious crimes that are guilty that don't have no remorse getting out, doing less time than you, and they have a sentence to die in prison. And I just didn't think the day would come. I lost my 20s, my 30s, my 40s. I'm 50 years old. But I have great people in my life, and the last 6 months have like been like a roller coaster to me. And I was speaking to one of my old attorneys, the one that got the DNA test, my appellate attorney. He's like, Sonny, you know what? What kept you going all these years in prison? Because since 2003, he was like my attorney. He was like, hope, Sonny. I used to talk to you all the time. Hope kept you. And I said, you know what? You're right. And so no matter how dark things get in life, you got to have hope. And that's what pulled me through. Those are tools I'm using in my life that are helping me and propelling me to my future. And that's what I'm going to do. And I'm just content and I'm just thankful and grateful that chapter of my life is over with. And just next chapter, next half of the storybook of my life, it's a different story. I can rewrite the ending. And that's what I'm doing now.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
And it's going to take us to heal us.
It's Mental Health Awareness Month, and on a recent episode of Just Heal with Dr. J, the incomparable Taraji P. Henson stopped by to discuss how she's discovered peace on her journey.
I never let that little girl inside of me die.
To hear this and more things on the journey of healing, you can listen to Just Heal with Dr. J from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
I want you to ask yourself right now, how am I actually doing? Because it's a question that we rarely ask ourselves. All of May is actually Mental Health Awareness Month, and on the Psychology of Your 20s, we are taking a vulnerable look at why mental health is so hard to talk about. Prepare for our conversations to go deep.
I spent the majority of my teenage years and my 20s just feeling absolutely terrified.
So this Mental Health Awareness Month, open the free iHeartRadio app, search the Psychology of Your 20s, and listen now.
Hi, I'm Radhi Devlukia, and I am the host of A Really Good Cry podcast. And I had the opportunity to talk to Davy Brown.
With women, any kind of thing where there might be this underlying edge of self-sacrifice as martyrdom, if you're never feeling, you're telling yourself a story and you're actually avoiding what you should be doing. You got to get in. You got to get your hands dirty.
Listen to A Really Good Cry on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to an iHeart podcast.